Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert N. Davis presiding. All the business before this court shall be here and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I am Judge Davis. To my right is Judge Solon. To my left is Judge Bartley. We are here today in the matter of Clyde McKinney Jr. against Robert A. McDonald, Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. The docket number is 13-2273. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Good morning, Your Honors. Landon O'Brien on behalf of the appellant, Clyde McKinney from the law firm of Chisholm, Chisholm, Kilpatrick. And joining at counsel's table is Melissa Best, also of the law firm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present their respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes of my time, if I may. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The Court should hold that the phrases defect, infirmities, and disorders, and injury and disease in 38 U.S.C. 1111 mean a disability within the confines of the Schedule for Rating Disabilities. The administrator and the solicitor of the VA, when the statute was enacted, both believed that the term defects, infirmities, or the phrases defects, infirmities, and disorders refer to disabilities. Now, specifically note what the administrator said in a statement to Congress. In the end part of this statement, the administrator said, even though such disabilities noted may not have been noted at the time of examination. Then the solicitor went on to talk about the same thing and approving the with approval of the actual enactment of the statute. The first part begins as to noted disabilities, the section is silent. Then it goes further as to noted disabilities. So, in effect, both the VA administrator, now the current secretary, and the solicitor both believe that Congress intended for it to be disabilities. And this is also consistent with the regulation 38 CFR 3.322, because a veteran cannot have a disability from, and I quote, the degree of disability existing at the time of entrance into service, whether the particular condition was noted at the time of entrance into active service, if there is no disability noted on entry.
What your arguments are in light of the various supplemental filings that seem to change directions. Are you still advocating an argument based on the pool's DOD rating system?
I don't think that's the controlling factor of the argument. The controlling factor is what we argued in the original supplemental memo of law that said the terms are interchangeable. We still believe that to be the case. The terms are interchangeable, but we believe that the terms actually refer to disabilities, since that's the thing that has to be aggravated. So there has to be a baseline, there has to be a consequence. If a veteran goes into service with a cold, for example, or goes into the entrance examination processing with a cold, that wouldn't be considered a disability. It, under the VA's reasoning, as pled, the actual, anything that were to be noted would, it's basically a catch-all for everything. And that would be absurd, because the entire point is the veteran is entitled to the presumption. And as Congress recognized back in 1943, they realized that a lot of veterans were being, had their disability severed because of the improper application of the presumption of soundness. And so the pulse factor is not really controlling here, because Mr. McKinney never had a disability, and that's our argument, is that 3.385 is the relevant regulation. And I realize that we did retract that concession, as the court thankfully gave us the opportunity to file a supplemental memorandum of law. But we believe 3.385 is relevant because that's defined the actual hearing loss disability.
Do we actually need to interpret the term defects, infirmities, or disorders, an injury or disease, or can we just rely on this court's decisions in Terry and Wynn when they discussed defects and the presumption of soundness?
I think you would need to interpret it, Your Honor. The language itself is not plain because they're not defined. Where it is clear, though, is in the legislative intent. And as I said, the secretary or the administrator in 1943 issued that statement recognizing those terms to be noted disabilities. You can only have a disability that can be aggravated if it is, in fact, a disability.
Well, getting to if we have to interpret it, then why wouldn't we rely on the secretary's interpretation that they're putting forward now and give them deference under Chevron?
Well, first and foremost, the Secretary's interpretation, one, it's unreasonable, but two, and most importantly, if that's the Secretary's interpretation and hasn't gone through notice and comment, the regulation that is currently in the 38 CFR 3.304 speaks to conditions. So the Secretary's regulation just merely parrots the statute but changed the term to conditions. And we would submit that the term condition still refers to disabilities.
So, counsel, disability in your position is disabilities synonymous with defects, infirmities, and disorders?
That is correct, Your Honor. We believe that those three terms really equate to disabilities because something would have to be noted. If a veteran, for example, as I mentioned earlier, had a cold, that wouldn't be qualified as a disability. Likewise, whenever a veteran goes into active military service, for the entrance exam, there's blood pressure readings taken. And if a veteran had blood pressure of a 140 over 100, that would seem to be hypertension. But VA has defined that in their rating schedule to say that it has to be done with three consecutive blood pressure readings to confirm that it was, in fact, hypertension. The statute wasn't created to penalize veterans, and the Secretary's interpretation at this stage would be penalizing the veterans.
Let me ask another question, Mr. Overby. Is there anything in the record that shows your client, the appellant, suffered a disease or injury that was manifested or occurred in service?
Is there
anything in the record that shows that there was a traumatic event in service that contributed to the hearing loss?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. McKinney had submitted a statement where he alleged because of the ship that he was on that he was exposed to gunfire and noise exposure. And unfortunately, there was not a separation examination completed, at least for the purpose of the hearing loss. But that's not detrimental because a veteran can still, as Mr. McKinney could do, establish a nexus between the current hearing loss that he suffers, the noise exposure, and I think that would be consistent with Hensley, because as Hensley noted, this court noted, you don't require an actual diagnosis of a hearing loss during service. Where Mr. McKinney is being penalized is because everything has been led to the examination being conducted under the inaccurate factual predicate that there was pre-existing hearing loss disability. And that's where everything has gone wrong, because 35 decibel loss would not constitute a disability under 3.385, and therefore, it should be considered that he was presumed to be in sound condition with no defect, disability, disorder, infirmity of hearing loss.
But isn't it possible to have hearing loss without it arising to a disability level? And so, you said hearing loss, disability, but the actual location was hearing loss, right?
There could be abnormal hearing impairment, and I would say that Mr. McKinney, within the meaning of the law, did not have a hearing loss disability. But as I said, there could be abnormal.
You're combining the terms here, which I think is an interesting argument, but you're including hearing loss and disability in the same phrase. And I guess what I'd like to address is whether or not one might have a hearing loss of some level, whether or not it's 35 decibels or 40 decibels. But if it's 20 decibels, is that a hearing loss that's normally recognized within the range of hearing. I mean, we all lose some hearing over time. What is compensable are hearing losses that are beyond the norm and that might be connected to some service activity, whether or not it's gunfire on a ship or, you know, tank fire on the ground. So hearing loss and disability is my question. Is it possible, given your position, that there is hearing loss without it arising to the level of a disability?
Your Honor, I would submit that there is decibel loss, and I know it seems like I'm parsing words, but there is a loss in decibels, but it doesn't rise to the level of a hearing disability. And I would have to submit, again, Your Honor, that that's the critical thing. Basically, Mr. McKinney didn't have anything noted on entry. That's the bottom line here, because he didn't qualify, or his hearing impairment or hearing loss did not rise to the level, as this court even upheld 3.385 in Palcheski, that Mr. McKinney did not have a hearing loss disability at the time of his entrance examination.
So you're equating it to 3.303 type things that are not considered disabilities for VA rating purposes?
Well, under 3.303A, if you're referring to like refractive errors, if those were noted on entry, then those would not be disabilities, because VA recognized those types of things are not disabilities. And if the Secretary wanted to further define defects, infirmities, disorders, he certainly can do so. But at this stage, and again, back in 1943 and 44, whenever the administrator and solicitor, they're the ones that spoke to disabilities. It was clear that they intended that you would need to have some sort of baseline to compare for aggravation purposes. That's why I referenced 3.322 as well as 4.22. The disabilities have to, something has to be aggravated. There has to be a consequence of something being noted on entry. Again, Mr. McKinney did not have a disability of hearing loss noted on entry.
But he had a defect, infirmity, or disorder noted on entry.
And I would just note that infirmity seems very broad. I mean, defect VA has interpreted several times, and I feel like it's open to interpretation how broad that term is, but an infirmity is something that would be less than an actual disabling condition. Would you agree with that, a lay person? If you were just reading it, you didn't know anything about veterans law, someone said they have a hearing infirmity. You wouldn't necessarily think they had hearing loss, but it just seems to be a broad term that something's wrong with their hearing, or it's weak, or, you know, very broad term to me.
Your Honor, I'm going to have to get back to your question. I'll try to remember what the question is, but
so why?
The phrases, the terms, defects, disorders, and infirmities, the VA, back when Congress created the law, recognized those to be disabilities. For example, and this would be absurd if taking the Secretary's position of the way that they read the statute, is that basically it could be anything. If a veteran actually, or a civilian goes into the entrance exam, has a tattoo on his or her arm, that could be considered a defect because it's not the normal thing of a person's body. So that's why it has to give meaning to what Congress was looking at, what the solicitor and the administrator focus on, disabilities, and again, tying all the statute, the legislative history behind that, as well as the other regulations, 3.322 and 3.385, but those have to be considered in conjunction. It would be really absurd to say that anything that is noted, again, going back to the minor cold, if I have the sniffles coming in, that would be an infirmity. But I don't think that's Congress's intent to say, well, we're going to penalize that person just because they were sick on the day they came in and had a minor cold. That, in my opinion, what the VA looked at when they enacted the statute was recognizing that it should be disabilities. And I apologize, Your Honor, I don't recall your question.
Fortunately, I do.
Okay.
The question was, wasn't there a notation on the entrance exam regarding his hearing loss? And under the category, the broad categories of disorder, infirmity, and defect.
There was decibel loss, yes. 35 at the 4,000 hertz level.
And there was a notation regarding the decibel loss. Right.
It was notated on the actual audiological audiometric examination.
It was not interpreted by anyone. That is, it was a figure, it was a number standing alone, what oftentimes is called just a test result.
Correct, Your Honor.
No one interpreted this hearing loss.
No one has interpreted that, and as we stated in our pleadings, that would require a medical expert. If the court were to find that it does, those three terms do not mean disability within the confines of the rating schedule, then that would require a medical expert to look at it and say whether it was a defect, whether it was an infirmity. But I think that goes to the pulse criteria because the military accepted Mr. McKinney, did not find that he had a problem with his hearing impairment, and that's where the pulse comes into play.
So to sort of play out your hypothesis or your hypothetical a little bit, rather than a cold, somebody came in with pain in their that was not attributed to any condition, but later it was determined that they had a torn ACL. Would that pain notation be sufficient to implicate the presumption of soundness and then potentially be rebutted?
It would not be sufficient to, the presumption of soundness would attach, I should say it that way, because the pain in and of itself is not a disability. Now, that's where the second prong of the presumption of soundness, if during the military service they discover he had a torn ACL, there's where the secretary has the clear and unmistakable evidence to rebut the aggravation prong, or first, the clear and unmistakable evidence of a pre-existing disability. And second, then they turn to the second prong of 1111 as to whether or not there's aggravation.
Okay, so to play out your analysis based on hearing loss, a veteran comes in, he has a loss of 35 dB on the 4,000 and 5 years later he's still in service and it registers now that he has 45. And so that would be considered hearing loss for VA purposes, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So would that then be sufficient to rebut that he had a pre-existing condition based on the notation of 35 dB?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. And I would say that the 35 decibel loss, and I know that I'm trying to explain it the best and answering Judge Davis's question as well, that yes, there is decibel loss, but what we are actually referring to is that there was no disability noted on entry. So in effect, there was nothing there.
But in my hypothetical, I said pain is not a compensable condition for VA. So under your analysis, that also wouldn't be a disability for VA purposes, but later on, it was diagnosed as what was the cause of the pain.
And certainly in this, using the two scenarios, even with hearing loss, the military could come and say that it pre-existed, it was pre-existing hearing loss. But the notation of 35 decibel loss does not mean pre-existing hearing loss disability. So the military, similar to the ACL, they could go through a medical evaluation board proceeding, determine that the veteran did in fact suffer a torn ACL, and that would, if they come with the sufficient evidence to show that it actually did pre-exist service, The military makes these line of duty determinations. They make the determination sometimes with explanation of why it was pre-existing or existed prior to entry and if it was aggravated. And that's the way the military actually even proceeds whenever they do the physical evaluation board and medical evaluation boards, is that they submit to determine whether or not there was basically a line of duty determinations.
So you're articulating that the military, even though he had only a 35 dB reading, had determined that that was hearing loss, then that would be a disability or a defect under your definition.
The military could try to do that, and again, I would say that because they're applying, as they call it, the BASR-D or the schedule for rating disabilities, whenever they're determining if there's something aggravated, they're applying the disability diagnostic criteria in Part 4 of 38 CFR. So I would submit that that is still not a disability because VA has defined that. again, using hypertension, they can't say that it was he was actually diagnosed with hypertension because it wasn't sufficient to, unless there were three blood pressure readings noted or taken on the day of the examination.
I think we just shift gears for a second since we only have a little bit of time left to your asbestosis claim argument.
Yes, sir.
Why shouldn't we just affirm the board's determination that he doesn't have a current disability and that his last diagnosis of asbestos-related lung condition was years ago, 10 years before he filed his claim?
Your Honor, I think that because these medical records that may exist out there that we've argued that the VA should or the board should have obtained these medical records, that they could be pertinent to the issue at hand, and Mr. McKinney would then be able to submit additional evidence at that time to establish current disability, but utilizing all the records available.
What time period were the records that
I believe they were from 1996, Your Honor. And
when did he file his claim?
I don't know the precise date. I'd have to look that up, but it was definitely after that, Your Honor.
So how would those records be more relevant than the records that are already in the record?
They probably would not be that relevant, Your Honor. Are there no further questions?
I just want to clarify one point.
Yes, Your Honor.
How much of your argument, this wasn't really clear in your briefs, how much of your argument is related more to whether the requirement of noting is met than whether the requirement of infirmity defect? In the first part of
11.9. I'm not sure
are you arguing that because there was no diagnosis or disqualification back at entry, diagnosis of hearing loss or disqualification due to hearing, that there was no noting?
That is correct.
Something? So you're not focusing only on the definition of defect, infirmity, or disorder?
No, Your Honor. It has to be read together because noting something is the critical thing about the presumption of soundness, and if the military notes something, i.e. the disability, it has to be read in conjunction.
So in Judge Schulman's example, if pain was recorded, I'm trying to think of a good word, knee pain was recorded, but there was no noting of any condition. What are you saying should happen?
They can annotate pain if they don't have an underlying cause of that pain noted at the or as recorded on the entrance examination. Pain it can be noted, but it's still not a disability. So it's the disability that is noted. And pain, again, is, as Sanchez Benitez says, it's not a disability. Pain is not a disability. No further questions?
Your time is up. You would like to send us a conclusion
of summary today. My rebuttal time is up as well?
No, I'm not.
I'll reserve my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. The board in this case correctly concluded that because the appellant was noted to have abnormal hearing on entry into service, that he was not entitled to the presumption of soundness. It's immaterial that his abnormal hearing did not rise to the level of a disability under Section 1110 to include as interpreted by the Secretary in 38 CFR 3.385.
Mr. Morris, let's start with following up on Judge Bartlett's question regarding noting the location of counsel just answered. If your opening was the infirmity disorder was noted.
That is correct.
You addressed her question.
With respect to its notation, Secretary's position that a notation is a notation, that hearing loss or abnormal hearing in this case is clear on the face of the examination report. There's a 35 decibel threshold indicating that the 4,000 hertz frequency. That is a notation. The notation, whether something constitutes a notation and whether it constitutes a disability are two very different things.
But to you, the fact that something was written down means noted. You don't require that it have been interpreted at all, that it have an overlay of medical interpretation about it to be considered noted.
That's correct. And the notation itself, its relevance or its impact, significance may change depending on what it is that is noted. But even referring to the questions of pain or of anything else that might not qualify as a disability, it's still noted. And the purpose of the presumption of soundness, the purpose of the statute, the foremost purpose, is to determine what condition did the veteran enter service in. And if something is noted on that examination, the veteran is regarded as having entered service with that condition. How that plays out, whether it's relevant to a potential claim for disability benefits filed years, if not decades later, is not relevant to what condition, in what condition did the veteran enter service.
How does that position work with the court's decisions in Wynn and Terry, where in Wynn the veteran had personality disorder noted in entry and later was diagnosed with schizophrenia after service?
I believe that in both Wynn and Terry it was not noted, which is why 3.303C came into play.
But I believe Wynn found that the presumption of soundness didn't apply, not because it wasn't noted, but because it was the kind of condition that VA doesn't consider to be a disability.
Yes, and both Wynn and Terry, I think, foremost need to be read in context. And what was at issue in both of those cases was the validity of 3.303C. And 3.303C sets forth certain conditions which, by their very nature, necessarily pre-existed service. I do believe that in both cases, the issue wouldn't have come up had it been noted, but regardless, and I'm just checking to make sure. And I believe that's critical in both cases, because it wasn't noted. So the, and I apologize, I forgot the question that I was just answering. But as to the language that was used in Wynn regarding the definition, or suppose that was cited by the appellant in his argument, as well as the impact of those cases, neither case stands for the proposition that where a veteran is noted to have a non-rateable disability, that he should be presumed to have entered service without that non-rateable disability. Both of these cases concerned, again, the interpretation of the term disability incurred due to an injury or disease incurred in the line of duty, as set forth in Section 1110, and that's what was being interpreted in those cases.
But if in Wynn it wasn't disqualifying such that VA could rebut the presumption of soundness, then why would it matter what was noted or not noted if it wasn't sufficient?
Okay, perhaps Terry might have instructed the subsequent case by the Federal Circuit in that Terry did seem to suggest very strongly that had the condition been noted, and in Terry it was a refractive error of the eye condition, that had it been noted, there would have been no reason to continue down with this challenge of 3.303C. That 3.303C, while it says that they're not disabilities, truly what they are not are disabilities caused by an injury or disease incurred in the line of duty. A pre-existing condition could not have been incurred in the line of duty. And I believe that the contextual language used by Terry makes that clear, that that is what the court was referring to, and I believe that's what the court was referring to effectively in Wynn as well, that these are conditions that simply could not have been incurred in the line of duty. Therefore, they don't qualify as disabilities under Section 1110, because Section 1110 makes clear that compensation is authorized only for disabilities that result from injuries or diseases incurred in or aggravated in the line of duty.
Right, but Mr. McKinney's disability, let's say, or hearing loss when he came into service was not enough to be a disability. So, by its nature, it's not something that could have been compensated if it had remained at that level, no matter what. So why is that not akin to the disabilities noted, conditions noted in 3.303?
Simply because it is something that could potentially rise to the level of a disability. A personality disorder will... The essence of 3.303C is that there are certain conditions that necessarily could not have started in service, could not have been incurred in service. Hearing loss, whether it's a disability or not, could have started at any point in time, but what we have here is a clear notation that the appellant's hearing loss, an abnormal hearing, started before service.
So it's the Secretary's position that if any noting of pain or an elevated blood pressure or any of these other kind of things that don't arise to a compensable condition on their own would be a defect that could be something noted that prohibits the
blood. That's correct. It's the Secretary's position that the defect, infirmities, and disorders language is unlimited and all-inclusive, and that Congress... The purpose, the paramount purpose, was determining the condition of a veteran when he or she entered service. And the question at that point is not entitlement to disability compensation. It's first to ascertain in what condition did a veteran enter service. So whether the condition that's noted qualifies as a disability is not yet relevant. And it's precisely for that reason that the Secretary would submit that Congress, in fact, used that distinct language in the statute, and as the Secretary had indicated in his pleadings, that we really need look no further than the plain language and perhaps the legislative history and the purpose of this statute to ascertain precisely what Congress had intended. And it's clear from the plain language, Congress used different language in both parts of the statute, and that itself indicates that Congress clearly intended the different language to have different meanings. And on the one hand, it used the language defects, infirmities, and disorders to refer to those conditions or abnormalities or imperfections that could be noted on examination. And in the latter part of the statute, in the context of the rebuttal provision, which arises only where nothing is noted, that it used the term injury or disease. Because the rebuttal provision only comes into play when there is a qualifying disability for which service connection or disability benefits could potentially be granted. Going to the ordinary...
Congress's intent. Why would Congress care whether they angrily rebut the presumption of soundness for a disability or for a condition that VA won't pay for? So,
But the Secretary would have no need to. If it's a condition for which compensation can't be paid, there's no need to engage in any type of analysis as to the veteran's condition. But if we do know that the veteran entered with a condition, whether it's a qualifying disability or whether it is simply a condition that could otherwise be noted, any type of defect, we know it's on the examination, and it makes sense that is the condition that the veteran is regarded as having entered service in. So again, the significance of that, that doesn't become apparent until there is a qualifying disability in the end. But as for what condition did a veteran enter service, it's what's noted on his entrance examination. And to that end, suggest that the legislative history is actually quite telling on that, in that Congress did have dual interests in mind when it enacted and subsequently amended the statute. And the first one was to ensure that no payments were made for disabilities or conditions that neither pre-existed and were not aggravated in service, because those conditions could not have been incurred in or aggravated in the line of duty. The second interest that Congress had was to ensure that the Secretary couldn't too easily deny benefits based solely on finding that the condition pre-existed service. So there is a dual interest. And effectively, Congress did create these two discrete presumptions. The first, albeit implied, is that irrebuttable presumption that what's noted on your entrance examination is what you had at the time you entered service.
You noted yourself that what was noted, or what's noted in many cases, is something that could potentially rise to a disability, but that wasn't a disability at the time.
That's correct. With all due respect, it simply becomes irrelevant. The notation becomes irrelevant if there is no subsequent disability. But it is not to say that a veteran who is clearly noted to have an abnormality should be noted on that examination, should be presumed to not have that abnormality when he entered service. That would be a more absurd and illogical result were appellant's argument to be entertained, that he clearly has abnormal hearing when appellant entered service.
Well, there's no interpretation at the time of the test result. So the doctor at the time who performed this, we're assuming it wasn't a nurse practitioner back then in the 60s, that's my answer, because there were no nurse practitioners. The doctor never interpreted anything. There was no notation of defective hearing here. The veteran got a number one in the pools test, and I don't understand it. It seems to be a simple test result, and I don't know that a condition was actually noted. It's someone looking back now that is laying their interpretation over the top of the test result and saying, voila, he actually had defective hearing back then.
Well, I would respond in 3 points. The first point is that in this case, we do actually happen to have a medical professional who has rendered that same opinion by looking at it. The VA examiner went back and noted that the appellant had abnormal hearing or hearing loss when he entered service.
Oh, right. But that's from the perspective of now.
True. But the perspective of the military and the service department is irrelevant. It is not required that the military acknowledge a certain condition or a certain defect as a defect or as a disability. Certainly the military has no reason to identify something as a VA disability, because again, the purpose of these examinations is fitness for service.
No, I agree with you. They have an obligation to identify something as a disqualifying disability.
And they did not.
Do you think that had to do anything with the time that we were in? We were in the Vietnam era. We needed bodies.
I believe that it has everything to do with the fact that this hearing loss did not impact upon the veteran's ability to perform in service. And it's totally consistent with VA's recognition of hearing loss as a disability, which, quite similar to the military, not based on fitness for duty, but is based on the idea of impairments in occupational capacity. So VA also recognizes that abnormal hearing, to a limited extent, does not impact that ability. And the military has the same reasoning. It simply did not affect this veteran's fitness for service, and that's reflected clearly in the supplemental authority that the appellant had submitted regarding the polling system, that's precisely what a 1 indicates. A 1 simply indicates that there is nothing that would impair this veteran's ability, or the service member's ability, to perform his military duties. And the secretary doesn't suggest otherwise.
But you did say that the doctor now said that the veteran had the effect of hearing that.
I believe the doctor qualified it as hearing loss, but the military doctor did not necessarily have a reason to go further. They specifically noted the numeric value, 35 decibels. 35 decibels at the 4,000 hertz. 35 decibels is a higher threshold than what is normal. Hearing impairment itself is simply the inability to hear as well as someone with normal hearing. The appellant in this case did not have normal hearing when he entered service. He could not hear as well as somebody with normal hearing. That is a defect. That defect was noted on his entrance examination. And by operation of Section 1111, the secretary is to regard the veteran as having entered service with that defect, abnormal hearing.
Well, let's talk about defect a little bit more. In other instances, for example, VA general counsel opinions, they don't interpret the term defect in the context of congenital conditions, which are not compensable. So that would be different than the definition you are advancing now.
Respectfully, the general counsel's opinions interpreting the term defect were the term defect as used in the secretary's regulations and within the phrase congenital or developmental defects. And the secretary, which had promulgated a regulation accepting those from qualifying as disabilities or diseases, had to interpret the term defect as used therein to be mutually exclusive with that which Congress had specifically authorized. So it wasn't a reflection of the interpretation of defect as used by Congress for purposes of determining a veteran status, but rather the language used by the Secretary in the phrase congenital or developmental defect being non-injuries and non-diseases. So the Secretary made clear that as used in that context, it was not meant to exclude diseases which Congress clearly authorized.
So we should not expect the agency to use the term consistently across its interpretations?
Respectfully, we were not interpreting the term defect. And in fact, I believe it's actually quite telling, because what the Secretary recognized when it interpreted the term defect to be exclusive of disabilities, that its ordinary meaning does carry an unlimited category. Because what the Secretary realized was that if read literally, it would have excluded diseases. It would have excluded certain diseases which Congress clearly intended that compensation payments be made for. So I do believe it is at least tangentially instructed that the Secretary was recognizing what the ordinary meaning of the term defect was, the same as this Court had recognized in Wayne and the Federal Circuit in Terry, that the ordinary meaning of the term defect is itself, and I believe it was this Court that used it, virtually unlimited.
But it also says amount to or arise from a disease or injury. So,
and again,
that loops back around to disease and injury, so it's a big circular.
And that was respectfully made in the context of this Court making clear that Congress could not have intended all defects, infirmities, and disorders to be qualifying disabilities for which compensation benefits could be had. So implicit in that statement is a recognition as to the ordinary meaning of these terms. And again, what the veteran or the appellant in those in Wynne and Terry was trying to do was get compensation for a quote-unquote condition or disability that the Secretary, by his regulation, made clear could not have been incurred in the line of duty. Again, a personality disorder in Wynne and a refractive error of the eye condition in Terry. So truly what was at issue in those cases was the breadth or the scope of the term injury or diseases. And this Court recognized that that was not unlimited, and the Secretary has done the same in his own regulations and his own general counsel opinions.
Counsel, even though the appellant in this case had, let's call it a defect, a hearing loss, and that defect did not arise to a level of disability for purposes of his interest in the service and performing his military duties, would you agree that there could be, he could have been diagnosed with a disability, in fact, not necessarily hearing, but any disability, and still may be qualified for active service?
Yes. There are many conditions. And there are many conditions, perhaps like hearing loss, which, again, just simply don't impact in a service member's ability to function. And in this case, hearing loss at a high frequency, 4,000 hertz, was one of those, and, again, is recognized by the Secretary today as something that does not affect the ability to or economic abilities. to quickly just respond to things that Colin said, while I still have a couple minutes, the tattoo example is perhaps, again, I would fully agree. If a veteran enters service with a tattoo, it is not a disability. If it is noted on the examination, it is quite apparent that we regard the veteran as having that tattoo when he entered service. The fact that it's not a qualifying disability, or if he got the tattoo, if the tattoo was forced on him in service, we would know that the tattoo existed prior to service because it was noted on his entrance examination. So I don't think that by any means there's any absurd logic in presuming or assuming that a veteran entered service with the very things that are noted on his pre-entrance examination. That is fully consistent with the statutory purpose as well as intuitive. Counterintuitive would be to know that the veteran had a tattoo when he entered service, and then somehow presume that he didn't, because that tattoo was not a disability. Regarding the appellant's repeated reference to the veteran having decibel loss, respectfully, that's there's no such thing. Decibel is a unit of, it's a measurement of the loudness of sounds. What the appellant was skirting was that he had hearing loss. Hearing loss because he required a level of sound, a loudness of sound that was abnormal, that a normal person would have heard sound at a lower decibel level. So, again, the appellant himself concedes that his hearing was imperfect, as he puts it in his pleading, and all but says the same, that he recognizes it was abnormal in this case when he entered service. It was noted, and it was a notation that is capable of lay observation. It was 35 decibels, and the board correctly determined that because that was noted, the veteran was regarded as having entered service or with that condition, and therefore was not entitled to the presumption that he did not enter service without that condition.
I have a question about the asbestosis claim. Why did the board not have an obligation to get some sort of opinion that would have harmonized the 1996-era findings that he did have a pulmonary asbestosis condition and the later findings that he had normal condition? I appreciate that it's not conclusive evidence
that he had a disability that would be compensable, but it's at least relevant that he had diagnoses of such a condition at one time. Especially, I believe that relevance is so attenuated. It was more than 10 years before the claim was filed. And at that point, with no further evidence, with no further indication, I do believe that it
was a chronic condition. So shouldn't its very nature, its chronicity, be the relevance,
with all due respect, that would seem to go both ways. That if it was a chronic condition that should have shown up on a subsequent examination, then it should have shown up on a subsequent examination. And in this case, it didn't. And in this case, the only indication was from more than 10 years prior to when the claim was filed, with no current medical evidence of any type of asbestos-related diagnosis. The appellant wasn't without recourse. The appellant certainly could have submitted his own medical records or could have sought an opinion himself. But as far as the Secretary's duty to compare a record from more than 10 years before the claim was filed and its own opinion, the opinion should control here, and that there is no evidence that truly weighs against that. And the board, in this case, did discuss it. It's not a case where the board simply ignored that older evidence. The board did consider the evidence and did recognize that it was more than 10 years old and that there was more contemporaneous evidence, and that contemporaneous evidence did not include any asbestos-related diagnosis.
Let me try to share with you my question on this for just a second. As I understand the appellant's position, the appellant was not disabled at enrollment, and the presumption of soundness should apply. If you look at the Hensley case, where Judge Steinberg noted that a pure tone threshold of over 20 decibels indicates some degree of hearing loss. And again, we have a normal hearing range, and then we have a hearing range. So the rating of 1 reflected that Mr. McKinney's hearing loss did not require any kind of activity limitation or adjustment. But it did reflect his entrance examination, did reflect the defect in hearing. So does that mean from your perspective that any pure tone number that's higher than 0, if noted on the entrance exam, could preclude application of the presumption of soundness?
No. The term defect would inherently contemplate it being an abnormality. If the normal range is between 0 and 20, then 25 or above would be the abnormality, given that it's in increments of 5.
Okay, so if that's the case, then what level would preclude application of the presumption?
Anything that falls out, anything that renders the hearing ability abnormal, so 25 and up, or greater than 20 decibels, at any of the tested levels. The statement shouldn't be taken to the far ranges of frequencies, but those frequencies which are tested on the audiogram.
To your knowledge, has that level been designated in any kind of statute, regulation, or a VA manual so that it might be consistently applied?
The 25 decibel level being that the first point of abnormality or outside of the normal range, I do believe is, or the secretary, is reflected in the regulation in 3.385 as well as in the regulatory history. In order to qualify as a disability, one of the ways could be by, believe it's 25 or greater in multiple categories, so 25 being that beginning of abnormality. So it is reflected to that.
26 or greater in at least three of the.
So it is. It is. And those
so,
that.
So as to the question that was asked, if you had a 25 in one, or let's say 26 in one,
That would also be an abnormality. It simply wouldn't qualify as a disability. And I believe that was actually, I should have referred to the history that spoke to where the secretary got these, the regulatory history. But yes, a 26 in one would also be a 20, I do believe they're in 5 decibel increments in the way that they're measured. But yes, anything that is outside of, that is more than 20. So if 21 were a possibility, that would also be abnormal. And the appellant himself doesn't dispute that either. The appellant hasn't disputed what's regarded as a normal range of hearing. And it is certainly clear that that 0 to 20 range, which was accepted by this court as well, based on scientific medical principles, is that range of normal hearing. And again, the appellant doesn't dispute it. What the appellant disputes is whether that abnormality rises to the level of a defect. And the secretary's position is that it certainly does. As one final point that I would like to add, though, or...
That position would severely decrease the number of service members, veterans, now veterans, who are covered by the presumption of soundness. Because I think it's not unusual to have a 25 in one of the 500 to 4,000 range frequencies.
And Congress has enacted a statute to address those situations, and that is 1153. Those are aggravation-based claims. Claims where a veteran service member starts with a certain condition and that condition is aggravated by service. Again,
yes, it's not that you can't get service connected. It's just the persuasion is on the veteran in those cases.
It is, but it's fully consistent with Section 1111, which clearly states that the presumption of soundness applies except as to those defects, infirmities, or disorders. Congress could have used the language injury or disease. Congress could have used the word qualifying disabilities. Congress could have used the language Section 1110 disabilities. But instead, Congress reserved the injury or disease language to the rebuttal provision of the statute, and at the beginning of the statute, recognized that a veteran was entitled to the presumption of soundness except as to those defects, infirmities, or disorders noted on entry. And in this case...
What about the appellant's argument that the VA administrator himself in the 40s or 50s inflated the terms and actually used the term disability to substitute for disability disorder?
Primarily, to look at Congress's intent here, not the administrator's perhaps inadvertent misstatement as to that meaning. What we're looking at the plain language, the history, and the purpose of the statute to discern congressional intent. What the administrator or solicitor said, and I don't necessarily agree that these were relevant terms, that they were not speaking to this necessarily, and I think they need to be read in that light. I see that my time is about to expire, but if I may just really quickly, regardless of whether this hearing, abnormal hearing, qualifies as a disability, there is no disability, hearing loss disability shown in service, and therefore the argument with respect to the presumption of soundness, it wouldn't be invoked anyway, because there is no indication of a hearing loss disability.
The injury
this court's case law and the federal circuit case law would seem to suggest that in order for the presumption of soundness to be invoked, there must still be a qualifying disability, and most recently in Gilbert and federal circuit cases beginning with Guy. I'm not suggesting that the veteran would not be entitled to direct service connection if assuming that there was no notation and that there...
Right.
But in that respect, the gunfire or the loud noises would certainly qualify as an news service event. So thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Overby, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. And I'd just like to address a couple points the Secretary has raised. Getting to the solicitor's opinion that was in the 40s, the solicitor, if I may quote the language, in other words, as far as the specific language of the amendment is concerned, the only cases in which aggravation must be rebutted by clear and unmistakable evidence are those in which the defect or disorder was not noted, period, as noted, as to noted disabilities. So the solicitor, and this statute has remained intact for 70 years now, or 60 years at least. So the solicitor had the viewpoint that we were referring to disabilities. And taking the Secretary's position to another extreme, it would kind of eviscerate 1153, because even 1153 talks about something being noted, and it basically talks about an increase in disability. So if something is noted on entry, it would have to be the disability. Otherwise, 1153 would have no meaning, because it says increase in disability. That's why Congress and this Court has looked at, especially like in Horn, and said there are two different presumptions. You have the presumption of sound condition, you have the presumption of aggravation. So Mr. McKinney submits that the defects, infirmity, disorders would have to be read to mean disability, because otherwise it would render meaningless many provisions. And even 1111 turns and references according to section 1110, which speaks to disability. So there has to be a baseline, and just because there is hearing impairment or abnormality, if we look at it that the presumption of soundness has been rebutted, we're looking at 1153, so Mr. McKinney would be harmed because he would have to show the increase in disability. And it's even more important because he had the injury, the noise exposure in service, so he is better off going through the presumption of soundness because he did not have that disability noted. And it would be the examination that was referenced, or at least discussed here today, the examiner was thinking that there was pre-existing hearing loss. And that was the factual predicate that the examiner relied on that predicate, and therefore the board used that opinion to deny Mr. McKinney service connection for bilateral hearing loss.
Mr.
Overby,
let me just ask a quick question.
Certainly.
It was Congress that wrote this legislation, not the solicitor. And you know as well as I do that Congress chooses the words carefully. Sometimes not so carefully as they should, but usually carefully. Do you have any legislative history that suggests that Congress intended defects, infirmities, and disorders to equate to disability?
There's not specific in there, but they do. I think the court in COTAN looked at the legislative history, and there's discussion between two congressional members, and they're talking. They're talking about might aggravate a disability, and that's at COTAN, probably May, I think it's 17, Bed App 126, where they're discussing the going back and forth between Mr. Judd and Mr. Rankin, and they talk about aggravating a disability. So they necessarily meant, because there are a lot of people where whenever they go into the military and they'd established service connection, their awards were being severed, and that's part of the intent behind this, and I think the General Counsel's opinion, 3-2003, also recognized that. The General Counsel, if there's any question about the interpretation of those words, I think the legislative history talks about the aggravation of a disability, so only a disability that would be noted could be aggravated. Otherwise, the presumption of soundness would go out the door.
I understand your argument.
We would ask this court to hold that the term defects, infirmities, and disorders equates to disability within the confines of the rating schedule, We had also asked that the court find that Mr. McKinney did not have a hearing loss disability noted on entry under 3.385, and therefore we'd ask the court to vacate the board's decision and remand the appeal for further development in accordance with the correct factual predicate. If there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. This case has been submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and recount. All right.